Hey everybody, welcome to the Snapcast. I'm Bobby.
I'm Jerry.
And I'm Chris.
All right, so this week, I mean, we're going to do it like we always do. We got what we've been up to and we got news, but after the break, we're going to come back and talk about something that's going to be an interesting segment, to say the least. I mean, it's pretty much, we're going to be talking about card cost theory. So essentially how, from a game development side, Wizards comes up with how these cards are costed, things that we see where they break away from the deviations, things like that. But more on that later. So first, I mean, what have you guys been up to? I know you guys went up to DC. How'd that go?
Oh, my. Well, it was a learning experience. This was, we went with Ben, Chris, and I, all three of us. It was a very learning experience for us. None of us had ever done a team sealed before. And turns out, I mean, we were on the right path. Everyone seemed to be playing the same three archetypes. You had the, and it even seemed to be really weird how the archetypes were based on seeding. The middle player, player B, which was me in this case, ended up getting the mid-range deck, the mid-range grindy rampy deck, the green-blue X decks, while a player on the right or the player on the left will have an ally aggro list. That was Chris's list. And then the other player would have an errant flyers list. It seemed to be the three most common archetypes, and we ran into a lot of mirror matches, which was awkward.
Yeah,
I didn't think that would happen, but it was good. It was a good learning experience.
Yeah, so just before we get too far to this, yeah, Team Sealed. Walk us through that. What was that process like? I mean, you get how many boosters for the team?
Okay, you don't even get, they don't even give you boosters to crack open. What they do is they have boxes set to the side with the boosters already cracked.
Oh, okay.
They already have the sealed pool on a list for you.
Nice.
You have to just verify that. You have 10 minutes to verify if that list is correct. And that was a little bit complicated at first, but once we got into it, we figured it out.
Yeah.
And we had the list completely good. We had no issues. The table next to us had a couple issues. I kind of like it, but I don't at the same time, because then there was a table that had four Chandras in it. I was like, okay, really? They had four Chandras?
Yeah, that seems a little crazy.
Super sketchy. Super, super duper weird.
Yeah.
I mean, and then even I had, you know, we had two Bearer of Silence on our side of the table. So I can't say it's too far-fetched, but at the same time, four of the same mythic, come on.
What were, I mean, but what is it equal in packs, though? Like, how many packs would it have been?
It's still a, what is it? It's a 12 packs. Eight oath for battle.
Okay. Yeah, so then you use that to build three constructed decks. These are 40-card decks, right? Like,
yep, 40-card, just like Draft and Sealed.
Okay.
The rules are is every card has to be allocated to someone's deck. Okay. Every single card. Hmm. So even if it's a junk card that no one's playing, somebody has to put it in their deck list. If not, you get hit with a game loss.
Gotcha. For, I mean, I guess then it's in sideboard, essentially, right?
Yep.
Okay. Makes sense.
Everyone's got their cards allocated as necessary.
Oh, that's crazy. So, I mean, how did the games go there? How'd the tournament go?
For me personally, I went 2-1 before we decided to drop and move on to the challenges. And, man, my matches were just grindy. Grind, grind, grind. Round one, I got caught against, I was playing green-black mid-range, and I got caught up against another green-black mid-range deck.
Yeah.
And I ended up beating him, but it was such a struggle, just pushing through, getting Bearer of Silence to get in through. With I had two Bearers and five Scion Summoners.
Nice.
So I got a, you know, I had a really nice pool, very wide version of the deck, so to speak. And this is just such a struggle getting through. But I ended up getting through on just Windmill Slamming Nissa World Waker.
Oh, nice.
Ticking down, pumping the dudes, killing him.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine, like, Limited can already be so grindy. So playing a grindy deck in a grindy format, like, yeah. So how about you, though, Chris? How did round one go for you?
Well, I didn't take round one. It was mostly just card draw.
Yeah.
I was playing red-white rally.
Red-white allies.
Yeah, red-white allies. So we had the rally triggers, or the rally thing was one of the big ones. Or what was the other one? You tap them and it does some sort of effect.
Yep, the cohort.
Cohort. And it was pretty strong. It was just because I played a lot of ally mirrors. It was almost down to if I got to a General Nasri in time to get the exact card that I needed or who was on the play. Gotcha. I mean, I fought where I could, but it just seemed like I played more green-white mirrors, and it seemed like for the allies it's just a little bit better. Yeah. And a lot of times that would edge me out unless I got that General Nazari out and got the exact card I needed to push damage through.
A good thing to remember about Sealed is because I was player B, Chris was player C, and Ben was player A. As player B, I can help both of them in their games.
Oh, nice.
I can directly tell them what to do. And one of the games that came down on Chris's side, and I feel bad because it didn't pan out for him, but he had a real interesting opener.
Mm-hmm.
It was three planes, two mountains, General Tazri, and an Expedition Envoy. One drop and a five drop, meaning cast them both on time, but nothing in between.
Yeah.
And I told him to keep it, and he drew three lands successively.
Of course, but if he hadn't kept it, it would have been three, you know, creatures right there.
Yeah.
Like, that's how it goes. But yeah, no, I mean, that's crazy. Like, I was a little bit jealous when you guys were up there, because, yeah, I've never gotten to do the Team Sealed, and it always just sounds like such a weird and wonky kind of format.
It is a ton of fun.
Like, even though we didn't do great, it's still just fun to sit down and play three random games and, hey, what do you think about this? Nudging your partner next to you. And I don't know. I had a blast doing it.
Yeah, there was one game. It was Ben's game. And he would have won it, too, because the guy he was playing against was not a very strong player.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy right next to him looked at his hand, looked at his battlefield, and told him play-by-play what he should do.
Oh, jeez.
And got him for exact seas on 12, and that ended the match.
Aye. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I've always been interested in two-headed giant, but it's just not, I don't like it, in effect. I don't like, you know, everyone kind of sharing, like, the battlefield, so to speak, and swinging at both their creatures. So it seems like this would be a nice complement to that. Instead of it being, you're playing your own individual games. But
next time. It's a lot of fun. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit more expensive, but the amount of fun and the talking and the building and, I mean, I'm not much of a builder.
Yeah.
You know, so I just told Jerry, I was like, you build the deck and tell me what I need to I'll try and get there.
His allies list was one of the sickest I had ever seen in Limited. He had 17 ally creatures and combat tricks. That was his deck. It was so good looking.
But most matches, like, I flooded out.
They were mirror matches. You know, it's who draws better. And it's like, well, go figure.
Yeah, so when you assign the player A, player B, and C, so you're always paired up against your equivalent on the other team?
Yeah, like player B will always play against B, C, gotcha. C, et cetera, et cetera.
And then how does, like, rolling for, do you each roll individually to start your turn? Like, who goes first?
Yeah, mm-hmm. They are their own individual games.
Okay.
You can help your teammate in any way, shape, or form. That is it.
Nice.
A couple other rules that come out. When you're, say, player A finishes, and he, you know, they want to help out, they move their chair over between players B and C, and they sit down.
Nice.
You cannot stand and help, because you can see your opponent's hand, sense. Possibly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. I didn't even think about that. Yeah, so, I mean, it's just a cool, fun format. I'm glad you guys got to go up there and do that. Any other thoughts, though, for it? Overall experience, things like that?
It's a blast. Go up there and have some fun.
Do it. And just at least do it once, so you did it for the experience.
Nice, yeah. All right, cool. Well, going down this list here, we had a bunch of invitationals this weekend. You guys get to catch any of that during all your craziness?
Not really, because once after the GP, we jumped right into challenges.
Oh, yeah? Nice. Yeah, I mean, I've been looking over deck lists, and I like what I'm seeing, but overall, I really didn't catch too much coverage. Really, though, looking at the news, the thing I was interested in here, though, is the changes to organized play.
These excite me a lot, by the way.
Yeah, this is a... you just mentioned challenges, so it's a perfect segue here. But basically what's going on is at Star City Game Grand Prix events, they're going to have the option for you to register for what they're calling an Infinite Challenge Registration Package. It's a bit of a long name. But, and I'm sorry, this is actually at Opens, too. So basically what you're looking at is a pass to play all side events and one of the classics. Is that right?
It's pretty much what it is. None of the 8-man pods. It's all the challenges, which are all 4-round Swiss, sometimes 5 if there's enough players, and you just play it out. There's no cut the top 8, and you get your Chuck E. Cheese tickets.
Nice. Yeah, well, yeah.
Real fantastic buy-in. Chris and I did the math behind it on just without the classic package. If you just do a challenge each day, you've made your money back and then some.
Okay. Just based on what the registration fees would be.
They're at $30 a piece. So if you put out the 80 and you do 3 challenges, one each day, you made your money back.
Nice.
And based on the way that, you know, we all play, I would do 2 challenges a day. It's 8 rounds of Magic in 2 different days, doing whatever you want.
Because what you can, I think if you time right, you can get 3 in of the same format. Because they start like right at 1 o'clock.
Yep.
And as long as they're keeping the pace moving, you can get 3. So if like you don't want to play in the GP, it's definitely worth it to do the Infinite Challenge badge.
Yeah.
And then especially like if you're not doing good at 1 and you're like, you know what, I'm done, I'll cash out. Because I want to hop in Legacy or whatever the case may be, it's definitely worth it.
At DC, Star City even did their first. They did a Vintage Challenge.
Oh, wow, nice.
And that one even had 16 players fire that off. And
that's what's up.
I was awesome. Like, I'm all about this. I could, honestly, if there's like an open coming into your area, but it's like a format you don't like, do this. Great substitute.
Yeah, it seems like a great idea. I mean, so this also gets you entry into the Classic on Sunday, right?
For the $100 payment, you get the Classic.
Okay, gotcha.
Because the Classic gives you a huge amount of Chuck E. Cheese tickets versus what the Challenge gives you.
Makes sense. Okay. So essentially, if you got the package with the Classic for $100, you're playing, what, all day Friday and Saturday? And then the Classic on Sunday?
Yep.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, that's a ton of Magic. It's definitely a good value. And I mean, it's... Even if you're considering playing the main event, this is almost better for certain players, especially for newer players, because, I mean, this gives you the opportunity to play one of these long, grindy days of Magic, but say you lose round 1 and 2 of your first one, you're not basically just out of the tournament. You know what I mean? Like, yep. You're not playing for fun like you would be at a, you know, a GP or an Open if you bomb the first few rounds. You're going to get a restart after a few rounds, and you could do all these mini tournaments instead. So, and, I mean, even for more experienced players, this is awesome, because, like you said, a lot of times we have Opens that'll come in our area that, like, are standard, and we're just not playing standard at the time, or we're in between modern decks or something. So, yeah, it's a great alternative. And then, yeah, if you love all the formats, you can bounce around quite a bit, too, and do it that way. No, that's awesome. I mean, it's cool to see them offering more things, especially something like this that essentially bundles all of the Chuck E. Cheese ticket events together, so you have more opportunity to get value out of that, I guess. I mean, at least if you're playing for tickets all weekend, you're going to have better chances of getting something decent off the prize wall.
Right? Exactly. Like I want a box of Saga. Off the prize wall. That would be insane.
And really, when you look at it, the inflation off the prize wall isn't as bad as I thought it'd be.
That's good.
Like, so you can... I mean, worst case, I think it's 10 tickets and you can get a water bottle. So if you win at least one match, you know, you can go get a Star City Games water bottle. You get something that says I
was
here. Is
this a reusable water bottle?
Yes. Oh, yes. Okay. It's not like, you know, Dasani. A bottle of Dasani. Yeah.
Those are 20 tickets. But yeah, no, that's very cool. I'm glad they're... I mean, it's just any company ever, I'm just excited when they're looking into their offerings and looking at ways to bundle value together for players. So very cool to see that. And it sounds like you guys are both behind it. I wish I had more time to dig into this. I'll have to look into it because it seems like good value. And yeah, awesome. Cool stuff. So now going down the list next is that Star City now has a maximum seating list for Opens. So what's going on with this?
It's just following suit with the whole Grand Prix. They're tired of trying to open up a hall for like another 50 people. That costs them a lot of money. They don't want to do that. And they haven't said you have to pre-register yet, but that's where this is leaning into. So from now on, big piece of advice, whenever you're going to your Opens now, just pre-register.
Yeah.
Don't try to do walk-ins because you might get denied.
Yeah, and so far, like, everything I've pre-registered for, they've been great. I don't think I've ever had to pay a pre-registration fee or any of that nonsense. Nah, it's the exact same price.
Same price.
And, yeah, I mean, like, you're saving yourselves time anyway.
And so. On the Star City website, there's the whole list of Season 2, all the seating capacities. They differ between wherever they're at. Some of them are, like, 900 max. Others have been 1,500 max.
Oh, that's great. So they already put up the numbers.
Nice. And that's set awesome. In stone. That is not changing.
Yeah, cool deal. And I mean, that'll be kind of fun too, because now I'm wondering, so I guess that means that at these events they're not going to be getting the weird side rooms anymore, or do you think they still are and just include that in the capacity?
You know, it could be part, like, could be one of the other. Doesn't know. I couldn't tell you.
Depends on the venue. Yeah. Yep. I'd be excited to see, because as White House at the end of the alphabet, I always have to start the day in that goofy little side room they have set up. I'm sick of that. I don't want to feel like part of the fun.
Exactly.
But all right, cool. Nah, but I mean, again, cool stuff. I mean, from a logistical standpoint, it seems mind-boggling that they haven't done this earlier, but cool. They're coming up. They're showing up to the party now. So now going into some modern talk here, there's an article posted on Channel Fireball by Brian DeMars that was essentially five changes that he thinks needs to be made to the format. Now, these were all ban-unban kind of ideas.
Ban-unban type of ideas. The article received a lot of feedback, which is why we're mentioning it.
Like, I mean, ban list stuff always does, right? Like, sore topic.
It got a lot of people typing paragraph upon paragraph in the comments. It was just good reads. Everyone had something pretty good to say all in all. Some people be shooting them down who have no business doing it, but...
Well, you know, you're always going to get that.
Yep.
But all right, well, let's go through this list and let's see how we feel about it.
All right, so his number five choice was ban Eye of Ugin.
Yeah.
The choice was either ban Eye or ban Temple. And his argument on that is Eye takes away the late game and it also takes away that hyper aggro early game. And that's fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, I think this one's probably the least controversial of the choices. I think we've said enough sort of on this one. So let's get to the good stuff.
Oh, number four is a good one. Unban Jit.
Oh.
So okay. His argument behind this is as long as Stoneforge does not get unbanned, Jit is safe. On top of that, Jit is on the same... He says, according to him, this Jit is on the same power level as Swords of X and Y.
Okay, all right.
I don't particularly agree with that.
Yeah, that's...
Because that's... 2 mana and 3 mana is a big leap.
Yes, especially in Modern.
But his argument behind unbanning, it makes a lot of sense. You hit a lot of linear strategies single-handedly with this card. You hit Burn, you hit Infect, and you hit Affinity. What more could you want? I mean, elves. You hit a bunch of decks that you kind of wanted to hit anyways.
Yeah.
So that people are still afraid of it because what it did in Standard.
I mean, I will say that to be 100% honest, I don't think I've ever thought about what Modern would look like with Jit but without Stoneforge Mystic. I guess in my mind, they're always just there together. So, I mean, not being able to tutor it up that easily, not essentially having, you know, five copies of it instead of just the four or, you know, however many more, but...
The argument is that when it was a Standard card, it was played in every single deck.
Yeah.
There was no real reason not to do it. Even in the mono blue control deck from Kamigawa, you were using Jit and attaching it to your spirit tokens that you were making off of Moloku.
So, yeah. I mean,
that's something.
I mean, it's a powerful card. Like, in powerful cards, that's probably the best measure for when a card is too powerful is it gets splashed into everything. And it's a colorless card, so it makes that much more... I mean... It's an interesting one. It's one worth thinking about. I don't think we're ever going to see it, but...
Same here.
Fun stuff.
Number three on the list was Unban Ancestral Vision.
Ooh.
This one was easy for me to see. Like, if you want to play a Cascade deck that builds into it, sure. We're already playing Living End. We're already playing Restore Balance to some degree. And Hypergenesis is out of the format, and that'll never come back.
So, yeah, it's pretty hard to abuse that side of it.
This card, as it stands, though, is we're not trying to use it in such a manner where we're trying to cascade, because the cascade cards aren't that good to compete with cards like Siege Rhino, Olivia, you know, Huntmaster, the whole crew of mid-range, and even Arcbound Ravager and such.
Yeah.
They're just not that good. So Ancestral Vision really comes down to blue mulligan is his argument. It is a one blue mana mulligan spell where you get to draw three cards, essentially, by the time turn four hits around. And it makes a lot of sense to me, because outside of turn one, I think it's a pretty bad spell.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, setting it up turn one and leaving it floating there for when it comes off suspension. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's probably much safer than Jit, that's for sure.
Definitely.
I don't think you're going to see a format warped by it. So, I mean, that makes it worth really coming back into the format and checking out. That one's pretty interesting, yeah.
His number two was a combination.
Combo.
Ban Goryeo's Vengeance or Simeon's Spirit Guide.
Okay, so ban one or the other.
Okay. First off, I'm not for banning either one of these.
Yeah.
Because it goes on my list of archetype slaying. Instead of killing an archetype, how about ban the actual problem card? We all know it's Gristlebrand.
Yeah.
We all know that Yawgmoth's Will is a broken card. So why is it fair to put it on a creature and then you can just reanimate it?
Yeah.
Like, this is the card that causes the most problems with these decks. This is where the combo chains where you start turn two kills happens. It's happening on this card. You take it out, you're now back to an old-school style reanimator deck, which is fine, and I think it needs to exist.
Yeah, no problem there. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, Gristlebrand himself, you're not hitting any other deck, really, at all in Modern. Maybe some weird fringe stuff people are playing with, but... Yeah, I mean, Simeon's Spirit Guide seems like a weird target... Goryeo's vengeance itself, yeah, I got to agree with you. Like, take out the piece that's broken of it and not the piece that enables the brokenness. You know what I mean? Take out the piece at the end of the puzzle, not the middle of it, because then at least they can play around with other creatures, other possibilities.
Yeah. Exactly. Let them actually play a true reanimator deck instead of this weird combo fireball deck that they have.
Yeah. All right, what do we got for the grand finale?
The final one, number one, unbanned Bloodbraid Elf.
Okay.
So, the question behind this was, when Bloodbraid Elf was banned, it was banned in the world where Deathrite Shaman was the real problem.
Yeah.
Like, they thought, oh, let's ban Bloodbraid because Deathrite had just been printed. It's not the issue. That wasn't true. So, Bloodbraid really caught splash damage of what Deathrite was doing. Now that Deathrite is out and Jund isn't playing a one-mana Planeswalker effectively, Bloodbraid's back to being at least the fair card it is.
Yeah.
Like, against other fair decks, it's gotta stand in front of a Siege Rhino, and Bloodbraid can't do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one that a lot of people have spent a lot of time talking about so far, and I think the general consensus is that it's pretty safe. You're not going to break a format with this. It's going to slot back into decks that it used to be in. It's not going to run rampant in other decks. Now, overall, though, he's looking at having all five of these changes made simultaneously, right? Not just one of these or...
Yes. This is because at this point, we've looked at the modern ban list, and it's been a slow grind of banning things.
Yeah.
It's not working because something always comes up to the top to dominate.
Right. It always will, yeah.
So instead of killing things, how about bringing some actual things back? You know, let things fight things. My controversial choice was unbanned Sensei's Divining Top. Miracles beats Eldrazi in Legacy. Miracles can beat Eldrazi in Modern if you give them the top.
Yeah, you're opening such a big door there.
Top's only reason for banning is because the argument of time constraints. This is no longer a valid argument. You get hit for slow plays on top very easily. If you spend more than 30 seconds looking at three cards with a top and a judge catches it, you're going to get hit.
Yeah.
So the punishment is real, and also the reward is real for playing the deck. So calling it out to being you're taking too much time with the card is not an acceptable argument anymore.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I have to say front, out, and center. I love blue-white control decks. I love Miracle. Like, yes, please give me top and modern. I'll never stop playing modern, but it's a weird one. I mean, top, I think, might be a little dangerous in the format just because of the time constraints, and it's been so wishy-washy in Legacy that I don't know if we want to bring that into modern. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
And I would like to see them I would like to see a resolute decision on top in Legacy. I mean, it seems like by not saying anything, they've said we're cool with it, we're going to allow it, but it seems like if you actually approach them and ask, their answer would probably be, oh, we don't know. And I really don't like that indecisive feeling in a format, and Modern has enough of that as it is right now. But I mean, overall, though, the list, though, from this article, I mean, it's interesting. I think it's one that would take... It's one of those things that's almost impossible to see what the end effect would be because there's so many moving pieces. You know what I mean? But I definitely agree with you on the principle that there are some goofy cards on the ban list that don't need to be on there anymore for Modern. And some of the, like Bloodbraid Elf, goofy may be saying too much, but it just seems like very safe to pull this off of the ban list. I mean, and I think if we're going to play with the ban list, now's the time. Like, things are all goofed up right now anyway. We've got this Eldrazi thing going on because of these cards they printed. Now's the time to go in there under the hood and tinker around because the format's already all messed up right now anyway.
Exactly.
So you might as well take advantage of this time period to just, hey, let's find out what happens if we do this. Like,
and because of this article, Ben and I got together and we played a ton of matchups of no ban modern. And we came up with our own modern ban list that was so much smaller and so much better that I think, like, I'll tell you all what we think should be left on the ban list, and this should be it. Rite of Flame, Cloud Post, Amulet of Vigor, Blazing Shoal, Glimpse of Nature, Cranial Plating, Mental Misstep, Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time, Gristlebrand, Hypergenesis, and Mirror Enforcer. That is a much cleaner ban list, much smaller, and it keeps all sorts of archetypes in check.
Yeah.
And it brings back old decks that should have the right to exist in this format. Granted, this was only on 2 days of play,
True.
But I mean, yeah, a lot of these cards were pretty obvious picks. Like, I was playing a Dread Return Dredge deck, and it's just not that good. It has its games where it can win, but you just get hosed so easily out of the board. So yeah. I really think R&D should go over and just play a bunch of games with just no ban list Modern.
And honestly, even if you don't want R&D to do the heavy work, let's host a tournament and let's say, all right, we're going to do Modern. We're going to test out this ban list. We're going to host a tournament and we're going to have pretty good cash payout and we're not going to have any entry fee. Here's the ban list that we have. Let the players figure out how it works out. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
There's tons of players out there who are playing at a very high level that would be willing to grind this tournament and basically spend weeks figuring out what the best deck in their opinion would be for this tournament. And then we're going to get a pretty decent snapshot of the meta right there for, you know, whatever the prize payout cost.
Exactly.
I mean, but yeah, I think I have to agree tons that unbannings, it's time for some unbannings. I mean, the best way to have a diverse format is to not have tons of things piled up on the ban list, right? I mean, if you have tons of powerful things on the ban list, then that means that you're leaving a few powerful things in the format, and that's going to create this kind of rock, paper, scissors kind of effect. Something's going to go to the top, and then you have a few close contenders, and that's your format, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so if you keep heavy-handed banning like that, there's no other real possibility. Something's always going to rise to the top, and the more things you cut off the totem pole, the less diversity you have under that one deck. So, yeah, I mean, let's go to town. Let's get some things off that list. But we are coming up on a time on this, so let's go ahead and take a break real quick, and we'll be right back to talk about card cost theory. All right, welcome back. So as promised for this segment, we're going to be talking a little bit about card cost theory. And as I mentioned before, actually, you know what, Jerry, tell us about card cost theory.
So card cost theory is what is used when designing a card. It's what you're trying to do is you want to make cards be equivocal to their mana cost to what they're doing. One power and one toughness is equal to 1 point of mana on your creatures. You know, one ability on each creature is one more mana that's supposed to be attached to that creature. You know, as for, you know, your red spells, for two damage, you add another point of mana to it. For counter spells, base cost of three. You see some two mana ones, they have drawback. You see a four mana counter spell, has a lot of upside. So these effects are, you know, it's trying to create a gauge on how a card should look.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's worth pointing out too that this is, obviously, you see some disparity between cards of olden days, especially instants and sorceries, versus what we see today. And I think a lot of that comes from R&D sort of developing this theory as they go along, right? I mean,
yes.
The power, the effect, like some of these effects on cards are hard to decide. So, I mean, things like drawing cards, it's weird to put a cost on that at first, the beginning of a game. So in the early days, we see lots of old busted cards because they weren't really sure what these effects should cost. And now, after years and years of Magic, we've kind of arrived at these formulas, essentially, that they've decided are par for what these cards should be.
Yes. A good example of, like, you know, the years of developing is Counterspell. Blue-blue counter-target spell. This used to be what they wanted. As years have gone on, R&D and Wizards have said, we do not like two blue mana counter magic. Counter spells will now be a base of three.
Yeah.
And they have stuck to that.
Something like Dissolve, Cancel, things like that. And yes, that we've seen that most counter spells since then, in the past, you know, I'd say, what, 5 years is fair to say, if not a little bit more. We've seen that base on it where Dissolve at three mana, well, Cancel was the first three mana, right?
Yep, Cancel from the original, from Time Spiral.
And that's where you get just a flat out, the new cost of a standard counterspell.
Yes.
It's the new version, essentially, of the old counterspell card that was just two blue. And then they decided, well, we can add Scry 1 to that for Dissolve, and that doesn't cause anything too busted, so you get a little bit of an upside there, and we've kind of gone from there. And I mean, obviously, like, in sets, you're going to see things that deter from this at the common level that aren't quite as powerful, things like that, but overall, I mean, this is par. So, yeah, so, I mean, overall, like, how do you feel about how Wizards has been costing cards lately? I mean, it seems like it's gotten to a place where it's more consistent, right?
Well, they've maintained consistency, that's for sure. but the power has clearly been sent to the creatures. Let me use Siege Rhino as an example here. Siege Rhino is 1 green, white, black for a trampler, 4/5, that lets you gain 3 life and an opponent lose 3 life. So let's use card cost theory to this. You have 4 mana for a 4/5. So you have an extra point of toughness already over. Mm-hmm. So it should be at about 4.5 to 5 mana already. You have trample attached to that. Trample costs an additional point of mana. So now we're at 5.5, 6. Then you have a lightning bolt effect. That's about a 1.5 mana. At 1 mana, we agree lightning bolt's a bit too much, but we let it exist.
Yeah.
So now we're at 7, 8 mana. You see where this is going?
Yeah.
Like, in theory, Siege Rhino should be a 7 or 8 mana card. But because it's in multiple colors, they feel that they could drop its cost a little bit.
Right.
Because being in multiple colors essentially does hurt it and constrains your deck design.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing trying to balance all of these and give and take away. Now, obviously, Siege Rhino is one where they thought at 4 CMC, as you said, with these 3 color costs, that would be prohibitive enough to make it a fair value, so to speak, on this card. But that card's seen tons of play, so clearly it's a little more powerful than 4 mana, even with 3 colors involved.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that typically when we see cards that, like, if they are a little off on this theory, and they, you know, let's say they price it a little bit under what you would expect to pay for the converted mana cost, then those are playable, good cards, right?
Very, very playable, very good.
And then the farther you get on that discount, that's when cards become busted.
Yes.
And, I mean, I think that's, with the Eldrazi minutes going on right now in Modern, that's where you can see a great effect of where these cards are pretty fairly priced in Standard. They're not taking over. But in Modern, where you have effects reducing that mana cost, these cards are busted.
Exactly. Another error in design is any design flaws have been involved with some type of costing effects. Affinity, Dredge, Storm, Eldrazi mana, Phyrexian mana. They all cheat the cost somehow, where at their cost, they are fair.
Yeah.
But you start getting into a world where, well, what if I'm doing these things with it? Now the cost is completely unfair.
Yeah. I mean, even Treasure Cruise is a pretty easy example where 8 mana, that card's horrible, but it has Delve, so they get into this weird spot where they have to figure out, well, how much are you going to be reducing this cost? How is this going to affect the card? In Standard, it's been fine, but in other formats where you're fetching and throwing things in the graveyard like crazy, card's busted.
Exactly. Another good example on, you know, busting the whole converted mana cost theory is Infect Creatures. You know, putting pump spells on Infect Creatures, Might of Old Kroza effectively gives any infect creature +8/+8
right,
in the terms of 20 life. Cards that give +8/+8 are 7-8 mana, not 1 mana.
Yeah.
So you see where the disparity lies.
Yeah, and I mean that's where we get, I mean, deck design comes into play because we get some great, interesting decks that abuse this. And then ban lists come up because we get decks that can just completely abuse some of these principles. So it's an interesting thing that's had to always exist in Magic. And I mean, I think stepping back a little bit, the mana system, playing one land a turn and being able to have these different effects at different speeds, so to speak, like instant versus sorcery, this is a really weird, delicate balance that Wizards has to watch out for, but I think it's also what makes Magic such a great game. I mean, Hearthstone couldn't be a better comparison because now we have a game where very similar principles, but you've cut out mana, essentially.
Yes. Hearthstone does not cheat the mana system. Magic the Gathering completely can cheat it.
Well, also, yeah, I mean, there's really no customization to the mana system, right? I mean, you're given 1 per turn and an extra 1 each turn as it goes on. You can spend those how you will, and there's no flood or mana screw. And I know a lot of people like the game because of that, but a lot of people like Magic, even if they don't want to admit it, because of this variable that's in the game.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a pretty interesting topic, and yeah, so we just wanted to take some time today to look at some cards over time and how cards have been affected and just how Wizards has upheld this sort of theory over the years.
All right, so, Chris, challenge for you.
Hmm.
All right, so, I want you to apply card theory that I just explained to you to Relentless Dead. Here it is.
Relentless Dead. We have Menace. When Relentless Dead dies, you may pay black.
If you do return at the owner's hand, when Relentless Dad dies, you may pay X. If you do return another target zombie creature card from your converted mana cost X from your graveyard to the battlefield for 2BB. Well, we got 2BB, so we're same color compared to black and X. So a little bit constrictive, but not horrible. Menace, so it can't be blocked except by two or more creatures. So now we have some sort of evasion. So mm-hmm. You'd think in theory we'd have to pump its cost, but then we have a lot of words below it. All right, so for black, I can return it from the battlefield or return it from the graveyard to my hand. And even if I wanted to, I could play X, which is just anything. And I can return a creature card on top of that from the battlefield, from the graveyard to the battlefield. At 2BB, that seems very broken.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of when you get the most interesting cases where you have these abilities that are not like... It's not flat out damage. It's not flat out. It's not an ability. Well, I mean, it is, but it's not, you know, a typical keyword ability. It's something a little more intangible. It's harder to really cost or to price what it should be at.
Yeah. And for the price, well, you have to start thinking, well, do I block and kill it? Well, if I do, look at all the other print that's on this thing with everything else it can do. It can still come back. It can bring creatures with it. For 2BB, it's a solid. I would say it's undervalue in terms of converted mana cost for everything that it can do.
Definitely. Now, here's my question to you, Chris. After applying converted mana cost theory, without worrying about any extra special things, what should its cost be based on all the effects and the power and toughness?
Power and toughness, well, 2/2 for 2 is fair, but we're in 2BB, so maybe we could go up slightly on its power and toughness. Returning it to the hand at black's okay, but now we'd have to apply that. And if I pay X, if you do return it, target zombie creature with converted mana cost X.
So how much do you think this card should cost?
I would almost want to say it needs to be 2 generic and 2BB.
And that's where I was going with it as well.
That's where I kind of say, with all the other stuff you need to get to, you can do with it. Now, maybe if we put it at 2 generic, 2BB, do we put it at a 3/3 instead of a 2/2? Maybe, but I think where it stands now, it is a mythic, so it's a value card.
Exactly. And that's where we look at it and say, well, it supposedly should be a 4-drop, but we got it as a 2/2 for 2. This is where we look at a card and say, wow, this is powerful.
2/2 for
this
2.
This is something we want to do.
Evasion. It has recursion, and then it has recursion, bring a buddy with you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty solid.
Exactly. And that is how you really want to look at cards. Another solid example I'll use, Archangel Avacyn, another new spoiler. Currently, it is a 5-mana 4/4. Flash, flying, vigilance. When it enters the battlefield, creatures you control gain indestructible. When a non-angel creature you control dies, you transform it at the beginning of your next upkeep. When it transforms, 3 damage to all of your opponent's things and your opponent.
And it becomes a 6/5.
Mana cost theory does have some hard costs here.
Yeah.
Flash, flying, and vigilance all cost an additional mana. Each 1 point of power and 1 point of toughness is a point of mana. So without the additional angel shenanigans that she's doing in the transform mechanic, right alone, she's already a 4/4 flash flying vigilant. That's 7 mana. We're already paying 5 for that. Everything else is even more.
Yeah.
So with the additional of the transform mechanic and the ability to sweep, sweeping for 3 damage has been arguably a 3-mana spell, and we're sticking it on a creature. This thing should be a 10-drop on the converted mana cost theory, but we're not getting that. We're getting a 5/5. We're getting a Sarah Angel with massive upside.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, because flip is hard because you want to crank the cost up for the 3 damage. As you said, that'd be typically a 3-mana spell. But then there's the condition that it requires to flip for that effect to happen. So it's sort of a if-then effect, not a guarantee. So then you discount some based on that. I mean, yeah, it's crazy to see how they come up with
these CMCs.
And
then add on top of it, whenever it comes into the battlefield, all your creatures get indestructible.
Like, even without the flip effect, this card would still be insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, the card's great even without the flip. I mean, And that's why it's so hard to price these, because it, realistically, if you made that an 8-mana card, it sees what, no play?
It would see zero play outside of some reanimator shenanigans.
But in the theory, that would be the fair cost for this card. So yep. It is kind of this weird thing where if you costed everything strictly to these kind of guidelines they've set, a lot of cards that we love would be unplayable. I mean, Snapcaster Mage is one that pops into my mind immediately. For 2 mana, everything that card does is completely insane.
Yes.
That card with, if that card were an instant that just did what it did, that's a good card.
Yes,
no exactly. 2/1 body, none of the other stuff. I mean, yeah. So it's tricky. And I mean, like I said, I think most, really, that's what Magic comes down to. It's like no effect is ever too powerful for the game, really. I mean, what would be the craziest effect in the world is this card can't be countered, you win the game. But if that costs 30 mana to do, well, you know, it's not that great. But then you play it in like some type of high tide build or some mana ramp, maybe now it's completely busted. I mean, so it's just no effect is too powerful on its own. It's all of the other variables and context that come with it. And I mean, unfortunately for R&D, I know that we won't get into how they playtest for Modern and Legacy, but you've got already a limited and a standard environment to think about. And then there is also Modern and Legacy and Vintage. I mean, like, it's crazy. It's crazy to have to come up with these. So you got another one we're going to look at here?
Now, let's go ahead and talk about rating Planeswalkers. We'll bring that up right now.
Yeah.
Planeswalkers are a completely different breed, and there's been the typical rule of four. The four things we look at to rate a Planeswalker. Does it cost 4 or less, or 4 or more? Does it provide card advantage? Can it protect itself? And does it provide an immediate onboard effect?
Yes.
So, Bobby, I challenge you.
All right.
I love these challenges, by the way.
Yeah, this is good.
Let's go ahead and rate Nahiri the Harbinger.
All right, so this one's a fun one, too, because I'm going to cover this up because I glanced at the spoiler, but I do not remember the CMC of this card.
Okay.
So, I've got the CMC blocked here. So we have Nahiri. We have Planeswalker, obviously, starting loyalty of 4. +2, you may discard a card. If you do, draw a card. Fine, right?
Whatever. Okay.
-2, exile target enchantment, tapped artifact, or tapped creature. Cool. Pretty interesting ability. I can dig it. -8, search your library for an artifact or creature card, put it onto the battlefield, then shuffle your library. It gains haste. Return it to your hand at the beginning of the next end step. So, overall, this Planeswalker is interesting, right? I mean, you have a discard ability, which with Madness coming into the set, that's much better than if Madness were not in the set.
Yes.
And with Delirium in the mechanic as well, I mean, there's a lot of power in discarding a card right now. And obviously, through Magic's history, you know, we have reanimator-style builds and things. That there's upsides to discarding a card. It's not all bad. Drawing a card, always sweet. Starting at 4 loyalty and jumping up to 6, pretty relevant. I mean, this is a pretty hard Planeswalker to get off the battlefield if you're hitting it with creatures or, you know, like burn effects, shocks, and whatnot. The -2, I think, is great. I love it. Like, being able to hit a tap creature is probably the mode you're using, you know, the most by a long shot. It helps to resolve the board state a little bit. Obviously, something that's tapped is bashing into you pretty hard, so that's something good to get off the battlefield. Hitting an enchantment is awesome just because it's not something you're going to be doing tons, but when it counts so much that it's great to have that tacked on there. And then tapped artifacts are kind of in the same boat as enchantments where it's good when it counts. It's so hard to judge the ultimate, so to speak, of a Planeswalker, the last ability, because you want it in history to be game-ending. This one in the right build is certainly game-ending. Something like in Modern or Legacy running the Infect Emperor or whatever. I mean, there's some busted things you can do with this, but in Standard Limited, it's not horrible. I mean, it's fine. So, starting at 4 loyalty, I kind of like the base off of that. I would give that about 4 CMC to start with. These abilities, I think, are all fair. Going up 2 is pretty good. Keeps it out of damage for a lot, and being able to get things off the board immediately is great. I think overall, I would come in at 5 for this Planeswalker.
And its final CMC is?
4.
Four.
So, pretty good.
Because as you explained yourself, it hits all sorts of, it hits a bunch of its, you know, must-have effects.
It's a great role player. I mean, it's going to come down and do work a lot of the time. The drawing card effect is...
It's card selection over card advantage.
True.
But it's like you said, if you're enabling your Delirium or your Madness mechanic in Standard, this is
very
fine.
Powerful.
If you're playing out of your graveyard, a la Snapcaster Mage, this is card advantage. We are very powerful at this point. So in a vacuum, not so powerful, but in the right conjunction of cards, this should be a 5-6 mana card, like you said. You said 5 yourself. I would have erred on the side of 6.
Yeah.
Because alone, say you don't ever plus it, this is 4 mana, exile 2 creatures.
That's 2 tapped creatures.
Tapped creatures. That's pretty strong for 4 mana.
Yeah, it's great.
That's tough.
And even if you exile one creature and then they swing everything at you off the table, that's exile a thing and then fog. I mean, that's pretty powerful for 4 mana. I mean, we've had to pay 3 mana a lot of times thinking of things like D-Sphere. And I mean, I know obviously there's more text attached to that card. But exiling is kind of one... Exiling is a weird one to price just because it's bounced around a lot.
Yes, it's been all over.
It's fairly new. I mean, obviously it's been around for quite some time now. But it's being used more and more now than ever where we have instant speed exiling. We have exiling tied to enchantments. I mean... So they're still kind of figuring out exactly where the exile effect falls. Then when you mix in the fact that the creature has to be tapped, that discounts... I mean, it's tricky.
Yes.
It's tricky.
All right. So, Jerry, I have one for you.
Sure. Oh, man.
All right. You're going to learn. It's going to be a Planeswalker.
Ooh.
It's going to be Arlen Cord.
This is tricky.
Yeah,
this might be the hardest one. You can't look at your phone at all.
Okay.
Can't look at your phone at all.
All right. So I'm trying to... I'm trying to remember all the abilities.
So I'm going to tell them to you. It's plus 1. Until end of turn, up to 1 target creature gets +2/+2 and gains vigilance and haste.
Okay.
All right. So +2/+2, vigilance and haste. One creature.
Yep.
0. Put a 2/2 green wolf creature token onto the battlefield and, however, comma space, transform Arlen Cord.
Okay. What's her loyalty starting?
3.
Okay.
3. All right, now the Arlen Embraced by the Moon, the werewolf version of this walker. It's +1. Creatures you control get +1/+1 and gain trample until end of turn. Creatures, so all of them. -1. Arlen Embraced by the Moon deals 3 damage to target creature and or player. Transform Arlen Embraced by the Moon. So it goes back.
Goes back to the flip side.
And then it's -6. You get an emblem with creatures you control, have haste, and tap symbol. This creature deals damage equal to its power to target creature or player.
All right.
Quick fix on that real quick. The -1 on the werewolf side is just creature or player, not and or player.
Yeah. Okay. Creature or player. That's what I was about to ask. Okay. So based on that, we have 5 hard abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have 1 ability that affects multiple creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another ability that has multiple possible targets, and an ultimate that is pretty much game ending. Her starting loyalty being at 3 makes her cost a little bit less in my eyes. So using converted mana cost theory, I effectively have 7 abilities, but her 3 loyalty pulls it off. I would give her a 6 converted mana cost.
She is coming in at 4.
Wow.
Now, you do have 2 colors, so a green and a red, and to me, that's kind of like a half of a mana, if that's fair. You know what I mean? Like, that's like a 4.5 cost, I guess.
What I think when we look at is, does it protect itself? So, at 0.
Yes, protects itself.
We get a 2/2.
Yes.
And we get to flip it. Do we get to activate again?
No.
No.
Transform Planeswalkers.
Trying to go to broken magic.
Transform Planeswalkers don't leave the battlefield, so it cannot activate again.
So, but on top of that, so we've protected it, we've flipped it.
And it does something on an empty board state.
And then the next turn it comes around, the same creature that we used to flip it, we are now pumping it. If nothing else, the same 2/2 we created is now a 3/3 trampler.
Okay.
If nothing else. Like that to me is just solid.
Yeah, I mean, this card's bizarre just because... We went way into the deep end here on this. Because
it's a tough one.
Flip Walker, because, you have 5 abilities, but 3 of them are on the flip side, and you're going to have to delay a turn to get to those. Now, obviously, you're going to get to pump out a 2/2, but you have to do that to get to the flip side. So if you want to plus you're not flipping, obviously. So, yes. I mean, like, it can kind of shape your game plan in a way in that sense. So,
and worst case is if you want to plus ahead of time to get a little space, you plus it before you zero it. So you give one creature +2/+2. And then you go with the zero. So now you have protection through the other creature. And whenever you flip, you have a little bit more room to move around and don't have to worry about just getting your planeswalker burned out.
The thing I love about this card is just that it's pretty clear that this would be in a creature-heavy build. I mean,
red-green monsters, probably.
Yeah, best colors to be in it. But you have one ability that's pretty significant to pump a creature, Vigilance and Haste. Great, if you have a creature. If you don't, you get to make one. I mean, that's pretty sweet for a planeswalker that, like, it slots into the typical build very well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, holy cow.
And I'll even go a step further. I think the card can be played in a pure planeswalker strategy. Nissa Voices Zendikar plus Gideon plus this is enough tokens to actually make all her abilities super relevant.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Yeah, with the new 3-drop Nissa, well, the newer 3-drop Nissa.
So,
ooh, she pairs with that Nissa real well.
It does,
ooh.
Right? But at the 4-mana cost, I think it's fair because, like you said, you don't get to just choose any of the 5 at any given moment. You have to flip over. You have to continue your turn sequence. You have to play each ability to each side. So and then you mentioned the color. You know, you have to be in red and green to play her. So I think she's fair at 4-mana, at 2 green and red. I think you're right on that.
4, I mean, I think she's very valuable at 4. I think that it's going to see tons of play. It's a great card. Like, I think 5 would have made the conversation real interesting because I think it still sees play at 5. Maybe as a 2 of, or, you know, like in some form.
Yep.
But it's still a good card at 5. So 4 just, I mean, that feels like a very good cost for this card. I mean, you have to do some wiggling around to get to the flip side, but not much at all. And it's not a bad thing at all. Like, if you flip those abilities and made it pump a creature and flipper or put out a 2/2, I don't even know. Like, evaluating that card would be hard too, because that's still really good. Like, it's a sweet card. I like it a lot. I think it's going to see tons of play, but I think 4 is aggressively costed for the card.
Okay.
So I think it's going to see play because of that. I mean, I think that, yeah, tons of value.
So the last part I wanted to hit on about with converted mana cost theory is with limited play. It plays differently in limited. You don't get access to every single card in a card pool, so you can't play the most busted things. So in limited, you tend to use it more as a direct rule. We'll use the typical... better yet, we'll use another spoiler. It's the new Delver of Secrets. What is it called again? It is Aberrant Researcher. Okay. In the past, we've had 3/3 flyer for 5.
Yes.
In limited, this is a pretty standard thing.
It's fine. It's fine. Limited card.
We absolutely love that. At 3/3 flyer for 5. Which, in Constructed, is very weak, because in Converted Mana Cost Theory, they should cost 4.
Yeah.
Well, Aberrant Researcher loses a point of toughness to go to a 3/2, and it goes down as a 4-mana flyer. 3/2 flyer for 4.
Fine.
Which is you still keep that power, which I think power is a little bit more valuable than toughness. So in Limited, this card's already looking to be a house.
Yeah.
Then it has its Transform, where can be card advantage, in the sense if you have any graveyard shenanigans, and it transforms into a 5/4 flyer for 4. 5/4 flyer for 4 at uncommon. This is probably the most powerful card in the limited format.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I mean, the one thing that limits it, no pun intended, that limits it in the limited format is just that it requires an instant or sorcery to flip, and it's a little bit build around.
A little bit. But as a 3/2 flyer for 4, we're already above the curve.
You're fine. Yeah. Yeah, you're definitely fine. I think this is going to be a great card in limited. At uncommon, you're going to see a fairly decent, you know, amount of these flying around. And yeah, it's a solid card. I mean, there is kind of a weird risk in decking yourself when you're playing a 40-card deck with this, but yeah, I think overall it's going to be great. I mean, within the confines of this set, it's not very hard at all to abuse this in some form. Between delirium and madness, you're going to get some extra value out of it, out of self-mill. I mean,
so you want my crazy limited call. Aberrant Researcher is a pack one, pick one every time.
That doesn't seem that crazy to me at all. I mean,
The exception is, of course, you know, jank mythics that just blow out limited, which there's definitely a bunch of them here. But if you're... I don't think right now there's even a rare that even stands up to this in limited.
Yeah, it's a great card in limited. I mean, but yeah, so looking though at the converted mana cost, four is a steal. The flip effect is kind of weird because I think, so a 3/2 flyer for four, I think that's fair.
That's really good, yes.
That's fair though. I think it matches the theory. It's pretty much par for the course, right? Because a 3/3 would be three and you tack on one for the flyer, so that's fair.
At four, it's fair.
The flip side of it pumping to a 5/4 is obviously a great deal, but it's contingent on it flipping, and it's going to be always delayed at least one turn.
Yes.
How many turns it's delayed is a variable. You're not sure. So honestly, like, if I had to price this based on CMC theory, I would go like 4.5. So I think shaving off the difference and going down to 4 makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because
your 0.5 easily comes with the fact that in order to flip it, you have to reveal a card.
Yeah.
So you give the player information, there's your 0.5, and we call it good.
Well, more than revealing it, you're throwing it into the graveyard.
Yeah.
Yep, you're binning it.
So you're self-milling yourself. I mean, and like I said, that's a weird one because that can be a detriment in some situations, but in most within this set and building round, it's going to be a positive.
It's going to be upside.
Yeah. I mean,
if you're playing pure delirium, you got it.
Yeah, so it's a real interesting card. But yeah, I mean, I would have to come in at 3.5. I mean, the flip side would be a 5/4 flyer, so that would be like a 6.
Yes,
if it were just 5/4, you know, flyers, typically.
Like a 6 or 7 drop.
And we would probably shave that down to a 5, would make it a somewhat playable card.
Is it considered a discard effect?
No, it is not. It does not trigger madness.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so you don't get
that. Because I was going to say, because now we have to start looking at it. If it does trigger madness, does it get even higher now?
No, you get the delirium effect of it, of just that you're more likely.
But what it does do is it does cheeseball some of the graveyard effects, like in Startled Awake or Jeroff's Masterpiece, both of which are mythics in blue, which you're in the same color.
In color.
Mythic,
yeah.
In color.
How about that?
And they get super cheesy graveyard effects. So it's there for you.
Yeah.
No, it's a sweet card. But overall, I mean, you know, we're coming up to time here, so we'll get to closing thoughts on this. But this is something that, obviously, it's not set in stone.
No.
This isn't rule of the land. This isn't. It's just sort of the precedent that Wizards has set over the years.
Yes.
And I think that out of any time in Magic's history, we're maybe at the most consistent time as far as CMCs go.
Yes.
We're getting a little crazy with creatures right now. I think they're starting to push the limits on creatures, but this is when we say things like that, when we're talking about power creep on creatures, when we're talking about how good creatures are getting, this is where that comes from, right? I mean, it's this, all this basis around CMC, and it's hugely important to the game. I mean, it determines if a card is playable or not, almost in 100% of cases, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, any last thoughts on this before we close this up?
Like you said, Bobby, it isn't set in stone, but it is a very valuable tool that I use when working in my limited formats and even constructed to some extent if I want to try something new that no one else is doing. Definitely a good tool to your toolbox. Use it if you want to. You don't have to necessarily, but it's definitely a very powerful tool in my opinion.
It's a fun thought experiment, and if nothing else, it kind of makes you a little bit more aware of where power comes from in cards, right? I mean, it's really the driving force behind it. So it's interesting to see, and I think it's also something that's worth noting, just looking at Wizards and what they do in designing these sets. I mean, this is insane. Like, just trying to keep consistent with this and also try to push the envelope on what creatures are doing and what planes, what all these cards are doing, while not breaking this, you know, over the top of its head. It's interesting. I mean, there's plenty of other card games that would just abuse this. I mean, if something costs 5 forever and then now we're making it 4, you're making the 5 cost version obsolete. You're replacing it. You're outdating those cards. Now we're moving into a crazier era. I mean, this is what drives power creep. So yeah, it's something good to note and take some time to think about. I mean, it's something that I hadn't thought about tons until Jerry mentioned it as a segment, and it made sense immediately. Like, yes, we need to talk about this. This is a great point. Any last thoughts, Chris, before we get on out of this?
Not offhand. I'm just looking at stuff.
Just looking at stuff. All right, we got episode title right there in the waning minutes. But all right, we're going to get on out of here then, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye. Oh, snap.